Good morning to everybody. Welcome to the class. We're commencing shortly with today's session on why the prophets were not mystics. We will wait for our friends to join on the phone. And we'll start momentarily. We'll be referring today to this past week's Parsha Kedoshim, which is chapter 20 in the book Leviticus in Vayikra. And we'll be addressing those seven verses from 1 through 7. As well as referring a bit to Maimonides, chapter 46 in the third book of his Guide to the Perplexed, where he addresses a number of these idolatrous practices. And hopefully we'll get to the root as to what the actual pull is, what the draw is, and the cause of these type of mystical tendencies in people. And again, we will start momentarily. And we ask that once you hear the audio stream, just type audio OK at the bottom of your browser window there. That'll just give us confirmation that you're picking up the audio stream properly. Okay, Rick and Susan, nice to see you again. Thank you for the confirmation. Hi, Dean Atlanta, Jeff Toronto, thank you very much. Parsha Kedoshim, Leviticus 20, verses 1 through 7. So we'll address again as well as the Guide for the Perplexed. And we should have a phone call in a second from our friends in Seattle, and then we'll start. Pause intermittently throughout for questions or any type of comments. Okay, Rosora, thank you so much. Hope everything's well. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Hey, Doug. How are you today?
Excellent. Thanks.
Good to hear.
Bill and Sean are with us, too. Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning. Who's that?
This is Bill.
Bill, how are you today?
Fine. Thank you, Rabbi.
Good.
Yourself?
Good. Thank God. I always enjoy this time of year.
It's starting to get warm out here in California.
The weather. Oh, you get good weather all year.
Yeah.
We're allowed to have good weather once a year. I mean, and we're allowed to boast about it too to you guys out there in the West Coast.
Yeah, it's gonna take a while to get used to this 90 and 100 degree weather.
That's what you have. You have 90 degree, 100 degree weather in California.
Well, it was 91 yesterday.
Well, you could always move back to Seattle, you know.
Believe me, I think about that once or twice a week.
All right. And Hillary's online with us today from Jerusalem. Thank you, Hillary, for the audio confirmation. We have the people joining on the internet also. So we just asked for the audio confirmation before we start to make sure everybody's picking up the audio stream fine. So it looks like we're good to go. And, Doug, did we leave any questions last week? I have a sense that there was something we left, or did I just suggest that we take a look at Kedoshim?
I think you just suggested that. I don't recall any outstanding questions.
All right. Okay, so to start, basically the topic which I suggested is the statement that the prophets were not mystics. They were not individuals that had any type of belief in mysticism. So the first question I'll ask you is, why did I pinpoint the prophets and nobody else? You have Jews as well, righteous Jews. But why did I suggest, or what would you interpret the reasoning is for why we say that a prophet would not be a mystic? So that's the question I'll put out to everybody as the first question.
But did you say why a prophet would not be a mystic?
That is correct.
Rabbi?
Cal?
Yeah, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I would think that it's real easy, especially in probably today's culture, to associate prophet with some kind of woo-woo mysticism. And I think it's real important to go back to the original source and see that they didn't use a lot of woo-woo stuff to do what they did.
What did they do?
Like they had their dreams and they were able to interpret dreams. Moses had a direct relationship with Hashem. I mean, these are things that are examples that we can use to help guide us more in an intellectual way rather than, a woo-woo way, because that is so appealing to the emotions that it can take us actually further away from truth and reality.
All right, well, let's define. I hear what you're saying. It's true. Maybe a good first step would be to define what we mean by mysticism or mystic. What exactly is meant by mysticism? We use the word a lot, but sometimes we're comfortable using a word, just having some sort of a sense of what it alludes to, but for our purposes, we should really define it clearly.
Wouldn't mysticism be considered some approach of getting knowledge that is not done through the normal manner of learning, but is kind of a shortcut? Where you are somehow given a direct pipeline into something you otherwise wouldn't have been able to understand.
So you're saying it's a means of obtaining knowledge?
Rabbi, my thought is that it's not so much a means of attaining knowledge as it's more of a means of attaining personal revelation and personal experience.
I don't know what that means, the means of obtaining personal experience. What does that mean?
Well, a person who claims to be a mystic generally does so based on a particular experience that they themselves have attained or they've acquired that either can't be duplicated by another person or any group of people, but it's something that's pretty much something that they personally experience.
Right.
And what they're doing is they're claiming that experience happens to be knowledge, and they're probably sharing that knowledge as such. But it's not something that if you look at Deuteronomy 13 and it talks about the test of a prophet, how do you affect that process of checking to see whether a person is a prophet or not if the person's whole veneer is based on personal experiences? I'm probably not making myself clear, but
Let me read a couple of some people online had some suggestions. Let's put more into the mix and see if we could, through everybody's statements, see if we could all come to agree. Yeah, that's what we mean, or this is not determine what we don't mean. Rosora is suggesting it's quote unquote a truth that cannot be explained by reasoning. D is writing that mystics would foretell the future. Prophets tell what may happen, but people can change what they predict. Hillary is writing she doesn't know why, but she does not associate it with the Jewish way of thinking in life. That's good, Hillary. I'm glad to hear that. Because if Judaism does not partake of mysticism. I think what we're all trying to allude to is that it's something which is, first of all, not real. It's something which is assumed to be real. You know, there's a word that we use in our you know, daily vocabulary when we're trying to apprehend what truth is. You know, in our search for truth, we have to invariably use the word nonsense, because we talk about what truth is and what we say is not true. So the word nonsense, if you think about it, it's something, it's you know, you break it apart, it's something which is nonsensed. We have five senses. And God's plan is why we have these senses. That means God created a physical, sensual world and put us here with five means of sensing the physical world. And I'm not talking about intelligence yet. I'm just talking about physical senses that the body is open to. And by the fact that he gave us five senses means that this is what you should use to determine what is true. Correct? God wants us to be aware. Since our life is a life in pursuit of knowledge, we have to have some means of perceptions. And so in terms of the physical interactions, he gave us five methods by which we can obtain knowledge of whatever. Knowledge of the existence of an object, the rough surface of the object, the color of the object, the moistness, the temperature, whatever the primary, you know, the accidental or the essential features of the physical world are, God allows us to have only five means to sense it. What does this mean to you if he only gave us five? If he only gave us... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the only thing is, a mystic might make an appeal to a sixth sense. You know, in other words, that there is some other sense of reality that transcends the normal five senses that we all accept as being five senses.
As long as something can be proven, but I've never heard that there is a proven sixth sense or ESP, any control, you know, action at a distance, all these different things that people talk about. I mean, if we talk about different examples of mysticism, you may have people that say they could move objects, or that they can foretell future events. And again, this week's Parsha, Kedoshim talked about a number of them where, for example, Nichush. Nichush was a practice where people would say, since a cat crossed my path, this is an omen that something negative is going to happen if I leave my house today. The reason why Judaism speaks against this and prohibits it is because there is no relationship, no causal relationship, nothing that we witness with any of our five senses that corroborates such a statement. And as Ibn Ezra says, the Torah prohibits that which is false, not what is true. Because there were certain Jews in Ibn Ezra's time, and probably before, and we know for sure afterwards because we see it today, certain Jews that would say, well, since the Torah is prohibiting witchcraft and all these different things, it must be true, but God doesn't want us to use it. So Ibn Ezra says, no, just the opposite. And he's very, I think it's in that area where he calls those people empty-brained people. He's very clear in terms of wanting to reject something which is absolutely ridiculous, and, you know, foolish. So he says, no, it's not true. The Torah does not prohibit what is true. The Torah endorses what's true, but it only prohibits what's false, because the Torah is objective. God's objective is that we understand what truth is and we stay away from a falsehood. And if we do not sense something with the five senses, so therefore we should not be making any suggestions that it's true, because God did not give us this ability to determine truth unless it's perceptible by five senses. Okay? Any comments, questions? I think we just have to lay down some foundation here. You know, going all the way back, we always have to keep in mind what the fundamentals are, what is God's design, and not veer away from what his intent is by just seeing exactly how he designed us.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal?
Seems like even through the five senses, though, unless you have a training of the mind, your emotions can be so strong that they can affect those senses.
Go ahead, give me an example.
Well, you know, you look at people who they see witness an event like a car accident or something happen, and you might get five different interpretations of that incident, and sometimes even descriptions are different.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's for sure. That doesn't have any bearing, though, on what objectively took place, though, and it's not something which they would disagree with you, that they maybe they have a different take on it. Those people themselves would agree, yes, you're right, maybe my emotions have gotten in the way. Somebody's asking, Hillary actually is asking, what about Ayin Hara, the evil eye? Is that superstition? The rabbis do mention the term evil eye, but we have to understand what it means. And I always quote the famous Rashi when Jacob was sending his 10 sons down to buy food in Egypt because there was a famine in Canaan where they were. So he sent down his 10 of his 12 sons because he left Binyamin behind. He did not want to part with Binyamin because Rachel, his wife, died. And now, for all intents and purposes, Joseph was now dead. So now his love for Rachel that was filtered through Joseph and now transferred finally out to Benjamin, he did not want to lose that, so he did not let Benjamin go down. He let Benjamin go down. So the brothers went down, but Jacob said, when you go down to Egypt, do not all enter through one opening. Go, each one of you go through a separate gate when you enter Egypt. And the reasoning was because they were men of great stature. They were strong. They were also looked very different than the Egyptians. And just imagine what it would be like if we were in Tel Aviv airport, and we saw 10 foreign-dressed people come in. So definitely our suspicions would be heightened, and we'd be on alert, and we may even, a person who's looking for an excuse may, cast aspersions and falsely accuse people just because of their own insecurities and suspicions. So Jacob did not want his sons to have any undue harm come upon them. So he said, don't do anything which is going to invite suspicion, which is what we refer to as the evil eye, or Ayin Hara, the evil eye. Evil eye just means that you're going to do something which will cause harm to yourself. People are going to look at you a certain way. So don't do it, that's all. But we don't believe there's any power. There's no Ayin Hara school that people go to learn how to cast any type of spells on it. We don't believe in this. This is not something, again, which is something that's perceived in the physical world. The only things we see in the physical world are natural law and man's muscular ability and his manipulation of the elements. And he can create fuels, and he can create explosions, and he can create buildings. But again, this is all based on physical law, nothing else. Okay, Rick and Susan are writing, we are told not to talk to the dead. Is that something we can do but should not? Or is this an example of what we cannot do, so we shouldn't try? Okay, it's a very good question. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking about, and again, Hillary, the red bracelet, the bendel, these things are, if you think about it, the red bendel, we talk about this a lot, it's merely a piece of cotton or wool, and when it was on the animal, we don't say it had any power, and then we take it off the animal and we twine it into a string, but it's still like a little off-white color. People wouldn't say that has power, but all of a sudden, when they take that wool or cotton and twine it, and then they put a red dye to it, now all of a sudden they imbue this thing with certain powers. It's an idolatrous notion, and it's completely against the Torah, and as a matter of fact, the Tosefta, which is statements by the rabbis that were not included in the Mishnah, but they are ideas that are true. The Tosefta in chapter 7 of Talmud Sabbath prohibits red strings because of the way of the Amorites, which basically means idolatry. Okay. Right, and Rivka is asking that in Job, I'll get back to Rick in your question, because that's going to be a little longer. I want to take it up, but Rivka is asking, in Job there were beings in heaven. What about them? We cannot perceive them with our five senses. Do they exist? Yes, we know that angels exist, because that's something which God speaks about. So if God tells us something, we can't perceive God either, but we use our intelligence. So I was only talking about physical senses, what we can use, what we can perceive here on earth in physical senses. And I did qualify that by saying that I was not referring to intelligence. We know that mathematics and that there are sciences, and that's something which we extrapolate with the intelligence, but the first step is to see the physical world, and then based on the world and seeing how God created many human beings, for example, now that means that we have to have equality. And then we extrapolate ideas of justice, and this is exactly what Abraham was able to do. So truths will come, but again, the starting point is using the five senses. We cannot start imagining things to exist and then create more ideas based on what we only imagine. And we'll get to this concept of imagination in a moment. Okay, but getting back now to Rick and Susan's question, again, you were asking, we are told not to talk to the dead. Is that something we can do, but we should not? Or is this an example of what we cannot do, so we shouldn't try? Well, if someone is dead, that means that there's no longer a functioning body. And if there's no longer a functioning body, so you cannot have interaction. Just like you can't have interaction with a rock. You can talk to a rock all you want, but you're not going to get an answer. The same thing in terms of the dead. The reason why the Torah prohibits this is because there is a strong emotion of love, and when somebody parts, so then we miss them, we desire to have contact with them. Now, there is a story in Prophets, which I'm sure a lot of you are aware of, where Saul was about to engage the Philistines, and he was very concerned, very worried. And throughout, we see that Saul had a certain type of an insecurity, a certain paranoia about David, and he kept on hunting him down. And even when he was first selected to be king, they found him hiding amongst the baggage, meaning there was a certain amount of insecurity. Now, at this point, the insecurity expressed itself again. So he went with two of his the members of his forces, or his army. And he sought out what the prophets called the Ashes Ov, or the Baalas Ov. Baalas means one who practices something, or one who is engaged in something. And Ov was a practice where they would do this type of, they would fool people, that they were talking to the dead as one of the practices. So the verses, if you read them literally, it says that as he was approaching her, so he disguised himself. But the woman knew, just because she was sharp, she knew that it was Saul, and she was able to make believe that she was bringing up the prophet Samuel from the dead, because this is exactly what Saul was trying to do right now. He wanted to get some input from Samuel, whether he'll be successful in the war. He was very insecure. God was not answering him, so he thought he'd go to Samuel. So when he gets to this woman, she says that she sees a man coming up out of the ground and with a white beard or so on. She describes him, and she knew exactly what Saul was up to, what he wanted. And all of a sudden, Saul is having a conversation, and he hears Samuel speaking to him. So it seems literally from the verses that this woman successfully brought up a dead person from the ground, and that Saul was actually engaged in a conversation, and he heard Samuel, and he was speaking to him. Now, you have to look at the commentaries on this, and the Radak, who is a very clear thinker, a very good commentator, he states that there were three parties that were at this event. There was the woman, the witch, the Baalas Ov. There was Saul, and then there were the two servants that came with Saul. So Radak says as follows. He says, the witch saw Samuel but didn't hear anything. Saul heard Samuel but didn't see him. And the two servants of Saul neither heard nor saw anything. Now, what does it tell you?
Well, each perceived reality differently.
Or
gotta be imagination.
Yeah. Exactly, meaning Saul was the one who had the desperate need to hear something. He was there to get information. Information doesn't come by visuals, it comes by hearing the words of Samuel, so he thought he heard something. And the woman just made believe that she saw something. She didn't see anything, she just said that she did. But the two servants of Saul that didn't really carry the way, they didn't see anything and they didn't hear anything because they were impartial to this need, therefore they were the ones that had the objective view of reality. And like Radak says, they didn't see anything at all. They didn't hear anything at all. So why then does the Torah go out of the way to describe it without making any type of a statement, without qualifying it? This is just a metaphor. So again, you have this when Solomon did not prevent his wives from idolatry. So the words themselves in the Torah accuse him of idolatry. But the rabbi said that he did not commit it, of course, but since he didn't prevent it, it's attributed to him. So here as well, what the objective of this story over here about talking to the dead is trying to show that this is how real it can be. The Torah wants to give you a sense as to how real this can be to a person. But you see that the rabbis did not take it that way. And they are the ones that God says in Deuteronomy we are supposed to follow the rabbis. And they are the ones that have the intelligence to unravel the Torah. So the sharper we are, the more we can understand. And the rabbis, who are brilliant, and Maimonides, who we just can't understand how he wrote, how much he did, and with the intelligence that he did. And Maimonides praises the rabbis. So certainly, if we see the rabbis writing something like this, so it's important that we don't just take it literally and ignorantly and ignore the whole system, which has to be a system of derivation and, you know, elucidation by those, you know, genius rabbis. All right, so if they give us the insight, we should follow what they're saying. So to answer your question, Rick and Susan, we are told not to talk to the dead because, like the Ibn Ezra says, the Torah prohibits that which is not real. There is no conversations you can have with the dead. So that's why the Torah is telling us not to. And God actually says if you really want to have information, so you speak to the prophet, and he alone will be able to, you know, tell you about the future events. But that's because future events, I mean, the whole reason why people are going to these palm readers today and horoscopists and the red bendels, people are looking to gain some foothold of security in their future. This is really a very big area of insecurity for people, and they just have not developed enough. They may have grown physically into adults, but intelligent, you know, in terms of their intelligence, they still have, you know, the maturity, the psychological, they're psychologically crippled, and they have the maturity of six-year-olds that still need mommy and daddy. And because of that, they're still looking for some replacement, because now they realize that their parents cannot give them that infantile security that they treasured and they relished so much. Now they realize that the parents are no different than they are. So now what do? They look to fill the void in their life of this security blanket by imagined forces. And these take the form of red bendels and talking to the dead and palm readers and the horoscopes. It's no different today than it was then. It's just a different flavor. That's all it is. It's the same insecurity. Okay. So we see that the Torah is telling us that these things are false. And our senses tell us that they're false. And if we do come across a story like this, now we look at the commentators and we see exactly why the Torah, in certain few cases, will describe it as if it's real, because that's what it's trying to show you, that it was that real to a person. But it's only real to them in terms of their need. And even if they would investigate it, they would see that there's questions, there's holes in their own theory. Did they really perceive something, or did they project something onto reality? A person can have that type of a blur between the lines. Was it a dream, right, or was it something real? Okay. So far, so good. Everything clear?
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right. Now, in terms of why we say the prophets were not mystics, I think we can answer that now, and that's because prophets are the ones that received communication from God and no other source. So they, more than anyone else, see, and when they sense the prophecy, they knew it was prophecy. And this was not something which they experienced in any other realm. There was nothing else that gave them this type of information. So when they saw this, it was clear that there is no other force. So therefore, this concept of, this notion, I should say, it's not even a concept, the notion of mysticism, that there's some way to predict the future, to control events, that there are these indications in the world of certain things. I mean, you think about it too, why is it like a black cat has become a popular thing, or a broken mirror? If you think about the actual phenomena that people correlate to some sort of a negative thing, Well, we see that, you know, black is something which we associate with like something devious or lurking in the night. And cats, they say, is sly as a cat. So they picked an animal that, they didn't pick a dog, they picked a cat, something which is a little more cunning, something which is a little bit more devious or curious. Also a mirror. Why a broken mirror? Because a mirror reflects your own image. And when it's broken, that is something which basically a person associates to you, yourself being broken. So if you think about the actual phenomena, a lot of times it lends itself just by looking at it as to why it was picked. So it's merely a projection of human insecurity. And the actual elements that people select unveil that truth. But again, since the prophet was able to, and people themselves also, I mean, people will see that they don't have any type of experience other than what they perceive with the senses. For a person was honest. But now a lot of people have this notion that, well, it can't hurt to do this as well. You don't know. You know, I've heard people say they have this thing in the Jewish circles called the segula, where they think it's some sort of a power. If I do X, it's going to be some sort of a redeeming quality, and it'll procure a certain good for me in the future. And the actual Sforno speaks, I think this is a 10:17. You should take a look at it. It's a very important Sforno. And he says, and Rabbi Mann actually pointed this out to me years ago, and it just stuck in my head. And there it says that God does not take a bribe. So what does it mean, God doesn't take a bribe? Sforno explains this to mean that if you have a sin that you have not repented on, don't think that any good deed or mitzvah that you do is going to extinguish the punishment that you deserve. You can do all the good in the world, but if you did not undo the sin, if you did not identify your flaw and have regret and remorse on it and realize its damage to you and your soul, if you did not realize that and you did not abandon it in the future and you're still holding on to that sinful way, it doesn't matter how many great mitzvahs you do. Sure, you'll get reward for those mitzvahs, but you're still going to be entitled to a punishment for the sin. So he says, that's what I mean, God does not take a bribe. He will not hold back giving a punishment on something you deserve just because you do many mitzvahs. Don't think you can bribe God with all of your good deeds. If he did a sin, that's it. But people who support the proponents of this view of segula, like some sort of a magical protective quality, so they think, oh, the mezuzah is going to protect me physically, or if I bake challah and I give the right, you know, if I separate the certain amount I'm supposed to, if I bake a key inside of this challah, I mean, the Jews, they use a lot of objects of mitzvah because they won't say that if I carry a rabbit's foot around, because that's too far from Judaism. But they'll take a Jewish object, like a mezuzah or a challah, something which is identified as an object of a mitzvah, and then twist it into some sort of an idolatrous cure or protective quality in the future. And they assume that this is now going to, if I'm infertile, so I'll do this, or I'll go into a mikvah, I'll go into a mikvah following a woman who's pregnant, and this will now cause me to get pregnant too. This is a belief that they have. So, this statement of Sforno completely rejects the belief that people have today. Because he's saying that if you have a sin, and that's the reason why you're infertile, so you have to perfect yourself. You can't just do other commands and assume that it's going to wipe clean your mistakes. The mistakes, it says in Lamentations, that we have to search out our ways and return to God. It's only through searching out our ways and repenting and returning to God and living properly, and you undo your flaw, then God will not have to punish you because you've corrected the mistake yourself. So we see that this concept is people aren't really, you know, listening to what the Torah says, or they're not studying enough, and they're following the masses that do this. And it's an unfortunate state of affairs, but the only route out of this type of a corrupt lifestyle is going back to the source, reading the Torah, seeing what the rabbis say, forgetting about what you see being practiced in day-to-day life. Okay.
So what?
Yes, go ahead.
When we look at the dreams of the prophet, say Joseph, and how do we know that, I mean, I'm sure they had other dreams. What's the difference between a prophetic dream and a regular dream? And, I mean, we can see in hindsight that, yes, those things did come true. But, I mean, where's the proof other than hindsight?
Well, the dreams that we know for sure are prophetic is if God speaking to him in the dream or an angel speaking to him in the dream. Then there's dreams where it doesn't make mention at all. For example, when Joseph was interpreting the dreams of the baker and the wine steward. So Rabbi Chaik gave a beautiful explanation, and this was not prophetic. Joseph knew that in 3 days was Pharaoh's birthday, and there was a need for a baker, the head baker, and the wine steward. And he saw that the two of them were in prison with him. So the dream that the wine steward had was that he saw a vine of grapes, and then they blossomed, and then the grapes came forth, and he squeezed the grapes into the cup, and he took the cup and he put it into the Pharaoh's hand. So Joseph said to him, "Your dream means this. The three clusters that you saw, I think it was three clusters, and he says, that means 3 days. And 3 days, Pharaoh is going to lift up his servant, meaning you, and place you back on your post." And he was so happy and relieved. But why did Joseph know this is true? Because the dream itself, the wine steward was very careful as he watched the grapes grow, and he squeezed them carefully, and he put them into the cup, and he was careful about how he treated the wine and delivered it to his master Pharaoh. So Joseph said, this is representative of the true nature of the wine steward, and Pharaoh will investigate and see that he was really, whatever he did wrong couldn't have been that bad, because he's a very careful person. So Joseph was convinced and that this is what the interpretation meant, but not through prophetic means, through his own intelligence, through understanding how to unravel the dream. The baker was so happy hearing the good news for his friend the wine steward that he also told his dream. In his dream, he had three baskets of bread and on his head, and on the top basket, the birds were eating the bread out of the baskets. So Joseph said this represented a carelessness, that he allowed the birds to eat the food, and he said this carelessness is going to be detected, and he's going to be killed. And sure enough, that's what took place. So dreams can be interpreted without the aid of any type of divine inspiration. I mean, this is something which, you know, is a very good explanation. We don't know if, we see the plan of God, that God's plan was the Jews should come down to Egypt. How did it start? The brothers had sold Joseph. Joseph went down. How did Joseph get sold? He had dreams. It initiated, the whole process seems to have been initiated through dreams. And it's interesting, in Joseph's dreams themselves, he saw there was a doubling of the dreams. So I always thought that the doubling of the dreams was not only for him to get excited and tell his brothers, and that would be the catalyst for him to actually be sold and go down, but it also trained Joseph in understanding what, because when he finally got the dreams of Pharaoh, that he said was prophetic. Okay, there he says prophetic, but how did he know what was prophetic and what was not? It could be that earlier, when he was 17 and still in his father's house, when he had his two dreams about the 11 stars and the sun and moon and the 11 sheaves bowing down to him. So the doubling of the dreams could have been indicative of a pattern in dreams. It's not typical when it's created by the human psyche, but only when it's prophetic. And when he saw the Pharaoh had doubling in dreams, this could have alerted Joseph, now this is now the same thing which happened to me. There's a doubling of dreams. And I believe the commentaries actually back this up. So it could be dreams are not prophetic. It could be they are, but it doesn't mention any angel like with Pharaoh's dreams. But there's a pattern. The design of the dream is something which somebody like Joseph, who was like the Rabbi Chaik explained, would be called the chief psychologist. He had a great insight into psychology. So that's something that you could determine even without there being an angel. Or there could be an outright discussion of between God and the person or an angel. And then we know for sure it's prophetic. So it's a long answer, Cal, but I hope it's clear.
Very good.
It helps.
So that's in terms of dreams. Again, though, that is something which is communication by God. That's for sure. We know it's true. But we have to separate that from our own intelligent derivation when we look at the physical world. And then the third thing, which is what we started out with, is just human perception, five senses. But in any of the categories that exist, the few categories exist that we gain knowledge, none of them are mystical. Mysticism is something which, you know, the Indians, you had these barbaric Indians that would scalp people and blood paint, and we mentioned we'd do a little bit of the Rambam, Maimonides, and Guy for Perplexed. So we were discussing this yesterday, and again, this is this parsha that we just read. So, it's interesting, Maimonides says, it's chapter 46 in the third book of the Guide to the Perplexed. And he talks there and he says that besides the prohibition of eating blood and idolatry, there is nothing else in the Torah where God makes the statement, quote, "I will put my face against that person," end quote. Only in idolatry and eating of blood does God say, "I will put my face against that person." Now, it was interesting that why it's this certain type of idolatry. He really commenced talking about Molech. Molech was a practice where they passed the child between two flames. Some say they burnt the child, some say they didn't. But the concept is that it says there that God will place his face against that person, meaning a real personal targeting of that person, where it is not typically said that in other cases. And it also says that by eating of the blood. So Maimonides talks about this, and it says what happened in the past. So people used to have this belief in demons. Demons just mean forces that they didn't see. And they would take an animal, and they would eat the flesh, but they would collect the blood of the animal, and they assumed that the demons or spirits were dining on the blood while they were dining on the meat, and they assumed that this would forge a good relationship between them and these demons, and that these demons or spirits would be kind to them in the future and give them good fortunes or take care of them in some imagined way. So Maimonides talks over there and he says that he quotes, you just gotta get it here. If you have the red Dover edition, it's page 363, and he says as follows. Okay. Yeah. Okay. They imagined. This is now in 362, about 10 lines down. It's in the middle of the paragraph. It says, they imagined that in this manner, the spirits would come to partake of the blood which was their food, while the idolaters were eating the flesh, that love, brotherhood, and friendship with the spirits were established, because they dined with the latter, meaning the spirits. They dined with the spirits at one place and at the same time, that the spirits would appear to them in dreams, inform them of coming events, and be favorable to them. Such ideas people liked and accepted in those days. They were general, and their correctness was not doubted by any one of the common people. The law, which is perfect in the eyes of those who know it and seeks to cure mankind of these lasting diseases, forbade the eating of blood and emphasized the prohibition exactly in the same terms as it emphasizes idolatry. Quote, "I will set my face against that soul that eats the blood," end quote. The same language is employed in reference to him who gives of his seed to Molech. Quote, "Then I will set my face against that man," end quote. There is, besides idolatry and eating blood, no other sin in reference to which these words are used. For the eating of blood leads to a kind of idolatry, to the worship of spirits. Okay. And he goes on, and he says, So it says, the object was thus fully gained to break the connection between these fools and the spirits, meaning the prohibition of blood, my mind is talking about. This belief, I guess, in spirits, this belief in spirits flourished about the time of our teacher, Moses. People were attracted and misled by it. We find in the Song of Moses, which is in Deuteronomy, and that's chapter 32, he says, quote, they sacrificed unto spirits, not to God, end quote. According to the explanation of our sages, the words lo eloka, which meaning not God, imply the following idea. Now, listen carefully to what he says here. He says, they have not only left off worshipping things in existence, they even worship imaginary things. This is expressed in Sifri as follows, quote, it is not enough for them to worship the sun, the moon, and the stars. They even worship their shadow. Okay. And he said the prohibition of slaughtering cattle for common use applied only to the wilderness, because as regards to the spirits, it was then the general belief that they dwelled in deserts, and there they spoke and were visible, while in towns and cultivated land they did not appear. Okay. So you see here, he starts pointing to something. He starts talking about spirits, and he says that in the Molech, which is passing the child through the fire and eating of blood, he says, besides those two prohibitions, there was nothing that God says in the Torah, I will set my face against that man. So now we'd like to, let's try to understand, what is Maimonides pointing at over here? And he says that the eating of the blood leads to a kind of idolatry, to the worship of spirits. And the Sifri, the rabbis say that they left off worshiping things in existence, they even worship imaginary things. Okay, he's stressing something over here. Now, what I think he's getting at is that one type of a deviation is assuming that a real thing exists, like the sun and moon, are deities. And this is what the Egyptians believed. They did believe in a supreme God, but they had sub-deities through which they would be granted fertile land and wealth and health and children, whatever it was that they imagined they wanted. So, that's one type of worship. But here he's talking about worship of spirits, imaginary things. And this is what was my mind's explanation as to why, in connection with the prohibition of blood, where they imagined that now we'll eat the animal, we'll collect the blood of the animal, put it in the pot, and the spirits will come and dine on the blood, and they'll be good, the spirits will be good to us. Now, of course, they didn't see anything. It was just an imagination, a belief. But God says, there, I'm going to set my face against that person, and he says it in connection with Molech as well. And Molech was where they passed the trial through the fire, and they assumed some good would come. So I think what he's pointing at, and it also says in connection with Molech, and another interesting thing, it says in the parsha we just read yesterday, and this is chapter 20, verse... three, that the person nullified or profaned my temple and nullified my name. It says that in connection with certain idolatrous practices. What's that additional statement? So I think, well, let me ask you, let me pause for a second. If a person would bow down to the sun and the moon, believing there's some superior being God, but the way I relate to God is by worshiping the stars, so it doesn't necessarily state that it's going to profane God's temple or going to degrade his name. However, in these areas where they assume these spirits and forces, this is something which is a desecration of God's name. And the response that God says only here, and in connection with blood, the response is that I will set my face against that person. Let's stop and think what this could possibly mean. God's trying to give us an indication as to what the crime is with his punishment. What does it mean I'm going to set my face against that person who who believes in the spirits. He doesn't say that in connection with the sun and the moon, if we bow to them, or if we assume that that's, you know, God's plan, that we should bow to the sun and the moon. Doesn't say it over there. Only says in connection with spirits. All right, let's pause and think about this.
Rabbi, does it have to do with the fact that if you're worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, at least you're focused on your five senses, and while that worship is misplaced, it's at least focused on something physical that you can see. But when you get into the realm of spirits, now you're in the realm of worshiping the shadow, worshiping things that you're totally making up, that don't even have any basis for proof of physical existence, and that is considered by Hashem to be a step so far away that it warrants, I guess, additional punishment.
Right. Now, here, that's a good point. I mean, it's such a corruption.
Right.
It's a higher level of corruption, because now you're leaving your senses. Okay, I hear that. That's actually what the Sifri is saying. He says they went so far. That's exactly what you're saying. It's a greater increase in the deviation. That they not only do they worship things in existence, but now they worship things that don't even exist. True. I think there's something else as well. I agree with you, but I think there's something else too. I think that the problem is here, you're now saying there's something besides God. I think it's more of an attack on God's exclusive role. So when you worship the sun and the moon, so this is more like in terms of, it's not on par with God. So it's not an attack on God per se, as if a person would say that God is two. To say that God is two and not one, there's God and there's another force, that is something which is a real crime over here. And God's response, I'm going to set my face against him, means to say that I'm the only one that could really respond. Don't think that there's other forces. When you get a destroyed life because you thought that you're going to bow down to the spirits and you're going to worship them and that you're going to have good things in life, but now look what's happening. Now, as a result, I'm going to destroy your life. So now you have to come to terms that what you thought was good out there that's going to take care of you is non-existent. And the only thing which is existent is me. I said the words in the Torah that I'll put my face against you. And now when reality comes and you are destroyed, you'll realize that I am the only one that really exists. I mean, the response is in order to correct the idea. You think there's something else out there. Well, let's see. Are you having a good life now because you worship these imagined spirits? No, you're not. You're having a destroyed life like the Torah says you will. So that validates God as being the only force out there that can respond to you. So when he says, I will set my face against that person, which it's trying to indicate that I am the only thing that can respond. You thought there was more than me. And if there was more than me, then you should have the good. You thought these spirits are going to take care of you? But no, when you see that nothing good happens, and now just the opposite happens, which is in line with the Torah's words, now this is the method by which you're corrected. So that's what God says in these areas, because now what you're doing is you're just seeing there's something outside of God. There's something other than God. That's what I think he's trying to say. What they left off of worshiping things in existence, meaning they left the physical world, and now they're assuming things that exist that are not perceived. And this may be a corruption, and like you're saying, Doug, that it's more of a deviation. It could also be that it's now diluting the exclusive role that God has in terms of being a force out there. A person doesn't think God's the only force. That's a worse corruption than if I just say that there's God, but the way I have to relate to him is I got to worship the sun and moon and all. Well, that these are the forces, the sub-deities by which I relate to this God. Maimonides even says this. He says in the beginning of the laws for idolatry that he says, Milo Yerucham, Melchim Goyim, who will not fear you? I mean, even the idolaters agreed with this, that there's the supreme God, but this is how the way you worship God is through these sub-deities. It's the system that they had. Rabbi Chavis will explain that when he was describing the culture of Egypt. So now we understand why it says it's a degradation of my name and it's the nullification of my temple, because the reputation of God is now is being destroyed with these extreme types of idolatrous practices. You see how that fits in now?
I admit that I don't.
Okay. Again,
run that over once more.
If we just say, and yes, spirits replace God. No, that's not the right thing. I was responding to somebody on screen. It's not that they replace God, but they're in addition to God. You're saying there's more than just God. There's also this thing called spirits, which is false. So let me just answer you, Doug. So that's if that is Doug there, it could have been Bill too. I didn't really.
Yeah.
You guys sound so much the same. All right. The difference that I'm trying to, the contrast I'm trying to create here is that there is a type of a worship where you accept God as the supreme being, but there's different ways to worship him. Or I say that God is not alone. If I say God is not alone and there's these things called spirits also, now that's a worse deviation. And that's why it profanes his temple and it desecrates God's name. Because now you're not saying he's the exclusive God anymore. You're saying there's other things out there too. Now you're saying that God's temple, well, that's not the only temple you should go to. So it profanes the temple too. Is that a little clearer?
Yes, thank you. Now I got it.
Okay, good. Yeah. But it's interesting. Like Rabbi Chaim explained, you know, you just let the words speak to you. It's so important to really just be sensitive to what the verses are telling us. And that's how we stay true to what the real intent of the Torah is, by not just projecting our own things on it, but really seeing what the words are saying and why it is to say it only in connection with blood and with Molech. Because I guess by Molech also they assumed a certain force out there. So they do an action of passing the child through the fire, but now there was a force out there, and again they were assuming some other force besides God. So it was a greater deviation. I was thinking also, like, why, you know, blood and fire? There could be there has to be a psychological emotion that this is catering to, that why they selected these. Okay, and Rivka is writing, by saying that there are spirits to worship, the idolatry is the degrading of who God is. Yes, you could say it that way. That what we're saying is that by saying that there are other forces out there besides God, it's removing God's exclusivity. Okay, God has to maintain, we have to retain that he is the only cause for the universe and how it operates. Okay, and Eleanor is writing, how would they differentiate between the spirit and Hashem, who is only a spirit for us to feel? Well, we don't feel God. That's not true. How would they, the idolaters, differentiate between the spirit and God? I don't think I have that answer. They would just say there's something which takes care of one realm of the universe, and then there's the spirits which takes care of another realm. So that's probably how they would differentiate. Okay. Now, yes, now I wanted to just mention, so why blood and fire? See, it could be that the categories that blood and fire belong to is respectively the category of humans, of life, that's blood, and fire is the external world, the elements. Now, people of an idolatrous leaning would look at blood as really being the soul. That's the life force. There's something in blood that gives you life. Well, it's not true. Life, you know, your existence, your soul is not something which has anything to do with blood, because when you're dead, your soul still exists. But they had to attach something to the physical world. It had to be rooted somewhere. So they attributed it to the blood. So that's why the blood had a very good, big appeal to them. Life. And fire could very well be because that's something which is animated. It's something which it has, you know, it lends itself to it. It's illuminating. And it has characteristics of that it flickers. And it's something which also, it can kill you. It can take away life. So both of these things could have been practices that started due to the psychological identification of these two elements with their close tie to what life is. Life depends on both being away from fire and having its blood. So just like another step as to why these were the practices. It's always good to get an insight psychologically so we can see where it comes from. And then this gives us more confidence when we see another practice that, you know, when we hear like people talk to the dead. So then, now that we see that blood and fire cater to some human need, and that's all it is, so now we could look inside a human personality and say, okay, well, maybe talking to the dead also caters to something. So, and the more we can uncover about the human psyche and how it works, the more we start seeing that there's nothing else out there. There's no powers out there. There's natural law, and there's our muscular ability and our, you know, our creativity, how we can manipulate the elements. And that's it. And the person could raise themselves above what, you know, these blind faith beliefs and just be true to what you see operating, then this is a very good path in life because that's being true to how the world works. And then you'll start rejecting anything which is just made up. There's, I had a conversation this week, somebody was writing in, and they're, you know, just to emphasize this point about how we should stay true to God's words in the Torah. So this is this website, Chabad.org. So they're writing on there how a Jew should be a Jew and a non-Jew should be a non-Jew. And that's God's will and that's how it should be. And is like they start talking with these words about that the goal in life is to see the spirituality that God put into every single physical thing. There's some element, there's some spark of spirituality, of kedusha, they call it, of holiness. And they keep talking about all these, and there's a concealment that God had to conceal a certain light to make room. And some people even say that God had to contract himself. God had to contract himself to make room for the universe. Remember Rabbi Chait responding to that and saying that this, to say that there's any connection between God and the physical world is complete heresy. That's just complete heresy. Because there is no connection between God and the physical. He created the physical, so it's not something which he partakes of at all. But the people have this belief where he had to make himself smaller to make room for the universe. But again, my point is that what they were saying is that there was a, they're using these words like concealment and spark of spirituality. And there's the hidden realm, all these different things, but they don't quote one single verse in the Torah. But the story that they weave is so appealing emotionally that, and they're a very big group, so people start thinking, well, they're so big, they must be right. Well, that's not true. First of all, you see that there's not one verse quoted. So where is their tie into Torah? Just because they're Jews? That doesn't make what they say Torah. And what they say, that a Jew should be a Jew and a non-Jew should be a non-Jew. Well, what about the fact that the Torah says in so many places, including this last parsha we read, that the person converts from being a Jew, from being a non-Jew to a Jew. So now he has the same exact Torah as the Jew. That means the same capacity exists in the convert as it exists in the Jew. Why God causes certain people to be born to Jewish parents or non-Jewish parents? That's God's will, whatever, that's not something we could ever answer. But we know that a person has the same exact capacity. And so what these people respond is they say, no, there must have been some spark, a Jewish soul inside the Gentile, and that's why they converted. So where do they get that from? The Torah, it's not in the Torah. Again, what that is, that's really just arrogance. They want to feel that the Jew is somehow greater, and therefore anybody who converts must have a piece of Jew in him. Well, the very simple rejection is all the Jews that kill other people. Where's the Jewish spark over there? So then they'll have to respond with some crazy answer. Again, they get caught up, and you can see very quickly, you can see right through. It's transparent. You know, these type of lies, this type of arrogance. And it's something which is unfortunate, but what I'm trying to highlight is that when we study, we look at the words, and God's message is going to be right there in the words. And if we're sensitive enough, we will see. And that's why we could see over here in this area where God says, you nullified my temple, you desecrated my name here, and I'm going to put my face against the person who believes in these spirits. It's pointing to a different type of practice than regular idolatry, where you just assume certain powers in the objects, but you still accept God. The proof is also, I should mention, that there's a Mishnah, which is, again, is the oral law. It is the authoritative oral law that we got at Sinai. And there's a Mishnah that says that there's certain punishments for people who do idolatry, and then for people who commit the practice of Molech. So the rabbis show, and they say that, you see from here that idolatry is one thing, and Molech is something else. Passing the child through the fire is not considered idolatry. It's a different type of a thing. Because the Mishnah itself makes a distinction between typical idolatry and Molech. So there's a proof that Molech is a different type of thing. And I think Maimonides really makes it clear when he quotes the Sifri, and he says they left off worshiping things in existence, and now they start to worship things that are not in existence anymore. So again, Doug, I agree with you that that's a greater deviation, and I think at the same time, it also points to something which is God has to mete out a harsher response. And he says, you think there's other forces that are going to do good for you in life? Well, look what happens when you worship those imaginary forces that you think are going to do good. You end up getting the curse that I said, that I'm going to put my face against you. So who's proven to be the only force now in the universe? God. God comes out as being the only force. That's the corrective nature. We see how God's trying to correct the person on the floor, exactly where their error is. But again, we get all this by being careful and being true to the words of the Torah, and not because some people or even rabbis make up these, you know, these emotionally appealing stories about concealment and light and your mission as a Jew and all these different things, and they don't quote one single verse because it's not something which is Torah. So we have to steer clear of that and always look at what the sources say. Okay, let me pause here. Any comments or questions?
Rabbi, just one quick question.
Yes.
This is Bill. The distinction between idolatry or the types of idolatry and the passing of the seed through Molech. The passing of the seed through Molech, that there's nothing analogous to that happening today. Is that correct?
Not that I know of. Unless they have like these satanic groups and they may do something, but I didn't renew my membership, so I don't know where they're up to these days.
Good to know.
Yes.
Thank you.
Don't quote me on that. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I think that's pretty much. You know, what I wanted to discuss. Any other questions? Any other comments?
That was very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
What do you plan on doing next week? Are you going to continue this theme? Or?
I don't know the future.
If I have a dream during the week, I'll send an email.
Next week, good question. Anything that any of you want to do? Why don't I put the ball in your court, think about it during the week, and confer, and I'll respond to what you'd like to do. Just give me a few days' notice on it. How's that? It takes the onus off of me.
So you're open to anything, huh? Okay.
Well, yeah. Doesn't mean I can answer it, but I'm willing to at least listen to what your suggestion is. That much I can promise. Yeah, think about something that, I mean, I think it's a good idea. Think about something which you really feel concerns you. But I do this a lot myself. I think to myself, what is it that I haven't covered that would be an important thing, just personally, in my own personal life? What would be an important thing to really review for myself, some new ground to look into? And it's sort of a type of question you can't answer, unfortunately, because if you haven't done it, you don't know what you're missing. but it's good to be thinking that way to try to address the fundamentals. So then you'll know to go back to the sources of the fundamentals, like Rambam or Albo, you know, Maimonides' 13 principles, and make sure you really have a firm grasp on those. And there's always going to be, you know, new things that you learn when you review over the words of the rabbis and the Torah, you know, in those areas. Or it could be something in the parish as well. You know, whatever you have an inclination to take a look at, I'll be happy to. All right?
Sounds good.
All right, so just, you know, give a call during the week or email, whatever. And, yeah, we'll do that next week.
Thank you.
All right. Hope you have a very nice week.
Look forward to you too, and everybody. Good to speak to everybody.
Thanks, Rabbi. Take care.
Okay, be well.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that ends today's session. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Later on this afternoon, if you missed any part of the class, it will be online under both the new postings link and also the audio link. And we'll be back here next week at the same time, 11:15 a.m. Remember, tomorrow night is going to be Rabbi Mann's continuation of a spring lecture series on Eliyahu and the Messianic Era. That will be 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow night. 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow night. Rabbi Mann will be giving that class right here. All right. Have a good week to everybody, unless we see you online tomorrow night. Take care.